Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. This week we present Marge Baker of People for the American Way, who discusses the testimony of government whistleblower Dr. Rick Bright, who provided Congress a detailed account of President Trump's catastrophic failure to effectively respond to the coronavirus pandemic. David Armiak with the Center for Media and Democracy, who talks about documents the center obtained, revealing the influence of the American Legislative Exchange Council in pushing state governments to reopen while the COVID-19 virus is still raging, and Sylvia Albert of Common Cause, who assesses the importance of ensuring mail-in ballots are a safe option in this November's presidential election amid the coronavirus pandemic. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Libya's brutal civil war reached a new threshold when on May 10th, forces loyal to rebel general Khalifa Haftar bombarded key areas in the nation's capital of Tripoli, including the international airport and the water supply. The bombing signaled a new offensive by Haftar, who is backed by Russia, France, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates. Haftar's troops also were blamed for shelling Tripoli's main hospital, injuring 14 people. Aid groups called for a ceasefire to allow health workers to respond to the COVID-19 pandemic. Reuters reports that in recent weeks, forces loyal to Fayez al-Sarraj, the head of the Government of National Accord, or the GNA, retook numerous towns with Turkey's backing, but failed to seize Haftar's Al-Watiya airbase. NATO is increasingly open about its support for the GNA, which has withstood Haftar's siege of Tripoli for more than a year. Over the past 12 months, the United Nations has verified 113 cases of grave violations of human rights, including the killing and maiming of children, attacks on schools, and health facilities. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg called for strict enforcement of an international arms embargo against Libya. He also supported renewed Libyan peace talks, which were cut short by the siege of Tripoli. The images of long lines of voters outside polling stations in Wisconsin's primary during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic continues to haunt the upcoming 2020 presidential election. Wisconsin's Republican legislature, backed by the state's Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court, forced voters to choose between risking their health and lives to the coronavirus and casting an in-person ballot. Alarmed by the GOP's brazen attempt at voter suppression in Wisconsin and the threat posed by the coronavirus, voting rights activists have launched a campaign calling on the states to permit massive mail-in and absentee voting in the November election. President Trump and his right-wing allies have attacked mail-in voting as corrupt. In February, Trump's campaign and the Republican National Committee announced they would spend $10 million on litigation and election monitoring in the 2020 cycle. Soon after, the GOP launched legal attacks on expanding vote by mail. Despite opposition by Trump and his supporters in the right-wing think tanks, ProPublica reports that many Republican-controlled states, including Georgia, Idaho, Nebraska, Ohio, Kentucky, and West Virginia are expanding voting by mail for the 2020 election. Political observers say that mail-in voting could influence the outcome of the election in critical swing states like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Florida, North Carolina, and Arizona. Surging unemployment in Florida's most important tourism industry make the southern state a prime candidate for a new housing foreclosure crisis. Homeowners have gotten temporary relief from mortgage payments, but face large lump sum payments this summer. Banks and mortgage services may offer extended relief or forbearance, but it does not stop mortgages from coming due. By the summer, homeowners may be forced to pay 4 months of mortgage payments or seek a modification in their loans, which could take time. During the Great Recession, 10 million homes were lost to foreclosure. Florida was among the hardest hit states, and community advocates now fear a new foreclosure crisis is on the horizon. The American Prospect reports that Wall Street and private equity investors are now pooling billions of dollars to buy up distressed properties. After the 2008 financial crash, real estate investment trusts bought up hundreds of thousands of apartments in distressed markets. Before the coronavirus pandemic, 7.5 million homeowners in the U.S. were already underwater on their mortgages. That number is set to skyrocket in coming months. Critics warn that economic conditions are leading to a neo-feudalism, with capital and property concentrated in the hands of the few and everyone else reduced to wage earners and perpetual renters, which could in turn threaten democracy. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
The coronavirus pandemic, the world's most deadly health crisis since the 1918 Spanish flu, has now claimed the lives of more than 320,000 people, with close to 5 million confirmed cases across the globe. Although the U.S. has just under 5% of the planet's population, the nation now has nearly one-third of all the world's known COVID-19 cases. While the Trump regime's wildly chaotic, incompetent and vindictive response to the pandemic has been on full public display for months, the May 14th congressional testimony of Dr. Rick Bright, the ousted head of the government's Health and Human Services Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, provided an insider's view of the president's failure to responsibly respond to the health crisis. The federal whistleblower gave members of the Health Subcommittee of the House Committee on Energy and Commerce a detailed account on how key government officials ignored his urgent calls to coordinate the distribution of personal protective equipment, medical supplies, and samples of the virus needed to begin research on vaccines and therapeutics. Dr. Bright asserted, "Lives were endangered, and I believe lives were lost." Your reporter spoke with Marge Baker, Executive Vice President for Policy and Program with People for the American Way. Here she discusses Dr. Bright's testimony and Trump administration actions that confirm their catastrophic failure to effectively respond to the coronavirus pandemic.
I mean, their testimony was incredibly telling and incredibly chilling. I mean, the first thing that was clear from his testimony is that Bright believes that lives were lost because there was inaction and unheeded warnings from the get-go. So, for example, with respect to the urgent need for medical equipment, such as masks, there were warnings about there's going to be critical shortages. You have to deal with it. And they went unheeded. And then when they started to try to ramp up, one of the things Bright said is that what they did is they were forced to go to other countries without quality standards to get the supplies. So when they did get equipment or purported equipment for doctors and nurses, it was defective. So that inaction from the very beginning, in terms of like critical medical supplies, even, for example, masks, led to lives being lost. So that's one really critical finding. Another one was, and this is what Bright said that led in part to his being removed, was that the administration was pushing the expanded use of unproven drugs. This is that drug, a malaria drug called chloroquine or hydrochloroquine, that was used to treat malaria, and it wasn't proven to have other uses. In fact, the FDA is now warned about the dangers of using the drug. But there was enormous pressure to ramp up huge supplies that they were going to flood New York and New Jersey with. And it turns out, not only does it not cure, does not help, but it can actually harm. And so those are the kinds of things that were happening because it felt like the administration was, number one, on the one hand, wanting to ignore the problem. So you have a problem with not ramping up on equipment. And number two, wanting a silver bullet. You know, we've got this great malaria drug that, you know, is going to cure everything, and it won't. So that kind of is kind of, the, in a way, the bandwidth of what Bright was telling us, telling the public in that public testimony. And again, you're absolutely right. This is from an insider's point of view. I mean, this was the office that was set up to deal with pandemics, to deal with readiness for pandemics. So he knows what he's talking about.
Marge, just a final question, and this is something that I am extremely focused on in recent weeks, and that is the need for accountability. When this pandemic is over and we can pick up the pieces and take a deep breath and be relieved that the illness and the dying is over, finally. In your view, what's the need for accountability here in terms of the mishandling of this pandemic that costs tens of thousands of lives? And I'll hearken back to President Obama. When he came into office, he really refused to delve into the illegalities committed by the George W. Bush administration in terms of launching the illegal Iraq War, the torture of prisoners, illegal surveillance, and even the fact that there were no prosecutions of any Wall Street bankers for their crash of the world economy back in 2008. If Joe Biden succeeds in winning the White House, what's the importance, in your view, of accountability for Trump administration officials and what they've done here?
I think it's important. I think we have to do, we have to literally walk and chew gum at the same time. We're going to have to, the horrors and the, of what are still going to be present in terms of the need to respond to the impact of this pandemic are going to be huge. And in particular, dealing with the inequities of how this pandemic has landed on communities that have historically been marginalized is something we're going to have to pay attention to. And so we got to do that. But Trump has shredded our democracy. He shredded our democracy by eliminating any kind of guardrails and putting in place henchmen who are willing to help him do that. So I think there has to be some accountability. I mean, I think what Vice President Biden has said is that that's why there's an attorney general. And this is what a new attorney general would have to have on their plate, is looking at what happened here, doing the investigations, finding out what accountability is appropriate. So I think we're going to have to do both. And I think we can do both. It's not one or the other. I think that's a false choice. But we've got to do both. And so it's going to be a really intense time, and it's going to need the support of everyone as we carry through.
That was Marge Baker, Executive Vice President for Policy and Program with People for the American Way. For more analysis and commentary on the Trump administration's response to the coronavirus pandemic, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The coronavirus pandemic caused most American states to shut down business as usual to varying degrees in mid-March, and now many are reopening in phases to gradually scale back the lockdown. But across the U.S., angry residents, some of them heavily armed, protested outside their state capitals, demanding that governors lift public health restrictions, many claiming that their personal freedom is more important than containing the deadly virus. Behind the scenes, an organization that for decades has promoted right-wing state legislation is using the pandemic to push for its policy priorities. A powerful corporate lobby front group, the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, is playing a leading role in the movement that's pushing for early reopening of the economy that's cost the United States more than 90,000 lives to date. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with David Armiak, research director with the Center for Media and Democracy. He recently co-wrote an article focusing on documents the center obtained, revealing ALEC's influence in pushing state governments to reopen while the COVID-19 virus is still raging.
ALEC, or the American Legislative Exchange Council, we have found played a role behind the reopen movement. Mainly, we have seen through some records that we've obtained that ALEC has scheduled meetings with Trump officials for its membership and corporate lobbyists that are also members to discuss reopening. The one meeting was with Vice President Mike Pence, who is a huge ALEC backer and is probably the highest connection ALEC has had, or deep connection ALEC has had to any administration up until now. And they've also held meetings with Betsy DeVos, who regularly attends ALEC meetings and speaks at ALEC meetings to advance her privatization agenda, her school privatization agenda. They've held a meeting with the Secretary of Labor, Scalia. So this is one avenue that ALEC has been working sort of behind the scenes to reopen our economy amongst this nasty pandemic that has now taken over 90,000 lives. The other way is it has circulated a letter, and that final letter asked policy leaders and elected officials, President Trump and state leaders, to reopen the economy in order to get people back to work. Eventually, there were about 150 members that signed on to this letter, along with a large number of Americans for Prosperity state chapter leaders. Americans for Prosperity is the grassroots or AstroTurf arm of the Koch political network, and some other right-wing allies. That letter basically argues that the curve is flattening. You know, businesses have taken a huge hit, and it is now time for, you know, the economy to open again. Shockingly, the letter asks not only for the economy to open again, but for businesses to self-regulate in terms of taking care of their workers. They say it is possible and profitable for employers to implement best practices to protect the health of their customers and employees without micromanagement from the government. You know, we've already seen in a number of places where, you know, that were deemed essential through all of this, that management at, you know, businesses, whether it be Amazon or meatpacking companies, have not done a great job at taking care or protecting their workers. In addition, the letter asks for reform in terms of tort reform. So they want state leaders in particular to pass laws so that once the economy reopens, business owners will not be held responsible if workers come down with COVID-19.
David Armiak, it seems like ALEC is almost the glue or the connection between the current COVID reality and this longstanding promotion of right-wing policies.
They do maintain a page on their website for solutions, or as they call them, policy solutions to the pandemic. And many of these are things that were already on the wish list of ALEC. So tort reform is one example for sure. Another is their school privatization agenda. So they're really pushing in the states the educational savings accounts, which, you know, are a sort of backdoor way of defunding public schools, the kind of suspension of environmental regulations. They have a whole page that they are directing their members to during this crisis to try to push through the state houses, you know, in the name of the crisis.
What's the connection, if any, between ALEC and these protests at state capitals demanding the reopening of various state economies?
There's a loose link. You also have the link in terms of funders. In terms of the sort of larger spectrum, I wouldn't say that ALEC, you know, is as far right as the reopened protesters that we've seen, say, in Michigan or in Wisconsin, you know, these gun-carrying militia folks, for example, who have taken up many of the images and video, right? And there's definitely a lot of people that aren't violent. You know, when I went to the protest here in Madison, we saw small business owners speaking, church leaders demonstrating, as well, right? So you get folks who are just frustrated that they've been targeted, or they think that they've been targeted, and, you know, places like Menards and Home Depot are able to continue to stay open. But ALEC in recent years has tried to distance itself from guns and gun policy, but its history is very different. It was behind the Stand Your Ground law, which resulted in the death of Trayvon Martin. And so we know that not too long ago, ALEC was very involved or had ties to the gun industry.
That was David Armiak, research director with the Center for Media and Democracy. Find a link to his recent article titled, ALEC Leading Right-Wing Campaign to Reopen the Economy Despite COVID-19, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. With the continuing health hazards posed by the coronavirus pandemic, voters across America will face a unique set of challenges in this November's presidential and congressional election. Without alternatives to waiting in long lines to cast an in-person ballot, it's likely that millions of worried voters will sit out the election. Efforts are now underway to ensure that all Americans have a safe and secure option to participate in this year's election that many believe may well be the most important in modern American history. One such option is undertaking a major expansion of the use of mail-in or absentee ballots. However, President Trump and other Republicans have attacked mail-in voting as ripe for fraud, but without providing any evidence to back up that charge. Trump admitted the real reason for his opposition to mail-in voting when he said on March 30th, if the level of voter participation was expanded, quote, you'd never have a Republican elected in this country again. When Wisconsin's Republican legislature and the GOP-dominated state Supreme Court forced voters to go to the polls during the state's April 7th primary election at the height of the pandemic, activist groups across the U.S. redoubled their effort to demand vote by mail and other safe options. Your reporter spoke with Sylvia Albert, director of the Voting and Elections Program with Common Cause. Here she discusses the need to permit mail-in ballots in all 50 states and the $4 billion in funding required found in the HEROES Act legislation recently passed by the House.
In a case like a global pandemic, the reality is that that is going to affect different communities in different ways. And so as we saw in Wisconsin, people are fearful. Some people will still come out. Some people will not. Some people will, start going to bars the day that it opens. And some people will take the time until they feel more comfortable. So key to ensuring everybody has access to the ballot is ensuring that the system is flexible and meets people where they are. So but that would mean, you know, increased early voting, absentee mail-in voting, different strategies. But the reality is that if we continue with elections as normal in November, then there will be millions of people disenfranchised because it is not a normal time right now. Vote by mail is safe and secure and ensures that we can have a free and fair election with different communities being able to access the ballot. There is no indication that it is more preferential to one party or another. In the last election in 2018, 27% of Americans voted by mail, so it's also not a new idea. There are tried and true tactics and programs to vote by mail that we know work, and we know how to implement them in a way that ensures both security and maintaining people's access to the ballot. There are some actual really interesting different models being explored. There are places using drive-through, looking at drive-through voting. There's curbside voting, mobile voting centers, which is when, basically got like a motorhome that goes from place to place so that it comes to the community. And you're basically kind of voting outside. But these are all great options, but we need to have options for in-person and at home.
President Trump has attacked mail-in voting as ripe for fraud without providing evidence, however, and he maintains that mail-in voting will be bad for the Republican Party. The Republicans have reportedly allocated some $10 million to fight vote-by-mail initiatives in states across the country. Give us an update, if you would, on lawsuits that have been initiated to block mail-in voting, which, as we've been talking about, may be critical to conducting a free and fair election in November.
Well, interestingly, they announced that they have doubled their budget. So the Republican Party now will be spending $20 million to ensure that voters, honestly, the only conclusion I can come to is that trying to ensure that voters do not have access to the ballot. So there are states around the country that generally have an absentee ballot excuse requirement. And in the era of a global pandemic, they have smartly and correctly moved to waive that requirement or have stated that everybody fulfills the excuse requirement because none of us have immunity to COVID-19. And what we're seeing is that RNC is already filing in these states. So in states like Virginia and Indiana and different places to say, oh, actually, no, we don't want you to waive that requirement. People should not be allowed to vote at home in a global pandemic.
The House has passed a $3 trillion piece of legislation called the HEROES Act, allocates a lot of money to states and frontline healthcare workers, and also $4 billion in funding for states to organize vote by mail and to secure the November election so that the most people possible can participate. The Senate seems to be saying it's going to block that specific legislation, but what's the hope here in terms of allocating enough federal funds to make sure we can all vote in November, regardless of the status of the coronavirus pandemic?
Local and state election officials of both parties really want to ensure a safe, free, fair, accessible, secure election in November. And it is they who are asking and pleading for the resources to be able to do that. So as we are advocating to Congress, what we are saying is these local election officials are telling you what they need. Please listen to them, because they know what their community needs in order to execute this election. The initial $400 million that was in the first CARES Act only covers, I think, something like 11 to 15% of the funds needed. And the Brennan Center has a great resource to kind of outline all of the steps that need to be taken to ensure a secure and accessible election in November. And the reality is we need Congress to step up. We need them to do their jobs to ensure that we have a real election in November.
That was Sylvia Albert, Director of the Voting and Elections Program with Common Cause. Learn more about the current effort to secure safe alternatives to in-person voting by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, KPFT in Houston, Texas, KGHI in Westport, Washington, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.